and welcome. Thanks for joining me for this week's Admission Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you get to that delightful instant when you can jump up and down and exclaim to the people staring at you because you are jumping up and down, "Yes, I'm in." And not only in, but in at the best program for you. Before we get to our interview with HBS MBA student and fellow podcaster Philip Blackett, I have a quick reminder. If you have an admissions-related question that you would like me to address, just go to the show notes at info.accepted.com/84, and you can leave a comment, which would be your question. Just use the comments feature to leave your question. You can also send me questions, if you prefer, via email at questions@accepted.com. If your question is chosen, I'll ask and answer it on the show. We're developing a wonderfully supportive and thoughtful community at Accepted, so please take advantage, post your questions, and either I or perhaps others will respond. Our guest today is Philip Blackett, who is the founder of Magnetic Interviewing, the host of the podcast called Life in the MBA, and a proud member of the Harvard Business School class of 2016. Now, that's what he's doing today. He's definitely not bored. Let me also provide a little background. Philip graduated with distinction from UNC Chapel Hill in 2007. He had a bachelor's in political science and economics. After graduation, he joined Goldman Sachs as an equity research analyst, where he worked for 2 years. He left Goldman to try his hand at real estate investing and small business marketing, and then joined FedEx, where he was the program advisor for FedEx's Global Citizenship Program, and then senior communications specialist for corporate and global marketing. He left FedEx for HBS, and now he has an email address that ends in at mba2016.hbs.edu. Philip, welcome to Admission Straight Talk, and happy belated 30th birthday.
Thank you so much, Linda. It's a pleasure to be on here.
Thank you. Now, I just want to go back to when you were the applicant, when you were in the shoes of many of our listeners. Did you choose to apply to Harvard for its brand? Or were there specific aspects of its program that attracted you, or some combination of the above?
You know what, I honestly would say it's a combination of both. I actually have to give you a quick story about this, because this is actually the second time around with Harvard.
Okay.
And this time around, I just had enough sense to say yes to actually coming to Harvard, as far as I'm concerned. So when I was in high school, I was a high school senior, I was in the shoes of many of your listeners at this point, except that I was applying to colleges versus business schools. And Harvard was my top choice. And I applied early action, got into Harvard College, and I pretty much was like, good to go, I'm set, this is where I'm going. A couple months later, my college guidance counselor told me, "Hey, Philip, congratulations again on getting to Harvard. We actually have this scholarship that the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill is doing, and our school is just now able to nominate people for this prestigious scholarship, and we thought about nominating you for it." And I was like, "Okay, that's fine, but I hope you know I'm still going to Harvard. But you know, that's fine. If you want to put my name in, I'm not thinking I'm going to actually get it, but that's fine." Fast forward another couple of months, not only did I got invited to do the final interview there on campus, but then shortly thereafter, I actually got the scholarship. And it wasn't just any scholarship. It's the Morehead Cain Scholarship, which basically takes care of not only just tuition and room and board and all the expenses. They provided a laptop computer, study abroad. Every summer you had something to do, like whether it's some sort of internship, or I spent some time in Brazil, or I spent some time in Lesotho doing some HIV/AIDS work, or even doing sea kayaking and mountaineering. Like every summer you had something, and all that was there, but then there was also the offer from Harvard.
And it was honestly,
I know exactly, right? This is how I was feeling. I was like, "Oh, gosh, first world problem, but goodness gracious, this is quite a decision to make." And so I had a really tough decision, and it broke my heart broke my mom's heart, really. when I came to the decision actually to take the scholarship and then go to the University of North Carolina over Harvard. So actually denying Harvard, say, "Thank you for accepting me, but I will not take the seat as I originally anticipated." And when my mom got the news, and she definitely wanted me to go to Harvard more than anything else in the world, I made her a promise. I made her a promise in the sense that, like, basically, I'm going to go to Carolina, take advantage of this really once-in-a-lifetime scholarship, make the most out of that, and afterwards I will do my very, very best to get into Harvard Business School. So that way it's like the best of both worlds.
And you did?
Exactly. And the thing was, that was over 11 years ago.
What a great story.
I like to think so, since it actually worked out, right?
Yeah, wow. Thank you so much for sharing that.
Absolutely. So, like, to get back to your question, yes, a part of it had to do with the brand, but another part of it had to do with fulfilling over a 10-year promise to my mother and to my late grandmother as well, because she always wanted me to go back to school, and I, you know, was hoping to do that before she passed from pancreatic cancer. But, you know, I know she's, like, looking down at me now, just like she's still, you know, gleaming with eyes of tears of joy, smiles from ear to ear, just, you know, fulfilling that promise. But along with that as well, I was really attracted to Harvard Business School as far as what they offered as far as the case study method. And I'm sure we'll probably talk about that later on in the program. Mm-hmm. But I fell in love with that because I honestly felt like this is a whole nother method of learning that I like stories. I like putting myself in the shoes of like actual people because I like watching movies and seeing how things are actually done. But I really was intrigued when I was sat in a couple classes at HBS and how things are taught by the case method. And I felt like that was like the thing for me, along with the fact that, you know, being up in Boston, I wanted to be in the East Coast again, and also was very interested in entrepreneurship. And I felt like, you know, a lot of people talk about Stanford and Wharton when it comes to entrepreneurship, but a lot of the offerings that Harvard was sharing that was provided for students really attracted me as well. So when you include all those things together, I'm sure there's probably many others, but I know we only got so much time in this podcast.
Right, and the question was what attracted you, so...
I mean, all of these were factors that attracted me to HBS.
Okay, great. What was the hardest part of the application process for you? Did you have any doubts whether you could get into a top MBA program, not to mention the top program? You know, I realize Stanford has a lower acceptance rate, but Harvard does have unparalleled brand, and it was very difficult to get into.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, it's funny you mentioned Stanford because that honestly was the first time I ever came across you, Linda. I think it was like some sort of, what was it called, MBA podcaster video that was,
A
profile on Stanford Graduate School of Business.
Yeah.
And that was where I first saw you, where you were sharing your piece on it from an admissions perspective. And I was like, oh, that's cool. So when I found out about this podcast, and you're like, oh, my God, like, I remember seeing her on the video like years ago when I was part of HBS. Like, full circle here.
Yeah, really.
So when it came to the application process, I think the hardest thing for me, and I tell this to prospective students as well whenever I see them around campus, is the whole sense of being vulnerable. And what I mean by that is when I was applying, I had, you know, when I was working on the essay and the application, there was a question about whether or not I should admit or share about my failed real estate venture.
Okay.
And that was something where it's like you think about Harvard Business School, you know, it's ranked, you know, number one, if not top three, if not number one, then definitely top three in all these different rankings. Like, this is like the school, like, you're kind of thinking to yourself, like, you have to be, like, top-notch, like, perfectionist, type A, like, you never failed in your life type application. And to me, part of it was like, do I share about this failed real estate venture, you know, that I did after working in Wall Street? And I was going back and forth on that. There was a dilemma that I was going through internally where should I talk about what I could safely talk about and just be on the safe route, or should I take a chance, really share what's really going on with me, and more importantly, share the lessons I learned from that, not so much just that I failed the venture, but what lessons that I learned.
Absolutely.
That more importantly are part of the reasons why I'm applying to HBS as far as what the three things were that I wanted to learn from business school so the next time I start a venture, I actually will become more successful at it. And after a lot of thought and consideration, I chose to take a risk. Mm-hmm. And I talked about it, and I think the biggest reason why was because I knew HBS was my top choice, and it would make the decision so much easier if I knew they wanted me after giving my all into it, as far as them seeing 100% of me. Not 90%, not 95%, but you see all of it, the good and the not so good. And if you still want me here, then I know this is definitely it for me. And it's one of those things where I've talked to people before where it's just like, I know that, you know, some of your listeners may be thinking about, you know, should I talk about some things that I'm not the most proud about or the most strong on? You know, should I share this vulnerable side about, you know, my experience and work? Or will this discount, you know, whether or not I get in? And what I would say is, you know, you want the school to accept you for who you are, like, inside and out. And that's how I saw this, in the sense where I took a chance because I felt like if HBS saw who I was from backwards to forwards, front to back, and they still said yes, then I know this is school for me. Because if I did go the safe route and I didn't get in like Harvard Business School, then the first thought that would come in my mind from then up to this day is, what if I was completely myself?
Right.
What if I completely was honest with them about what's going on? Would they have accepted me? That would be a what-if scenario I would have played out the rest of my life. So I didn't want that. So I was like, well, at the very least, if they don't accept me, then I can at least say I gave them my very best. And so what I tell people, when you do apply, whichever school you're applying to, make sure you give your very best. And that way, no matter what the result is on the back end, you know you've given it your all and you don't have any room or any reason to feel bad about yourself.
Okay. Well, your response is kind of anticipating my next question. Now, sometimes it can appear to people outside HBS that Harvard is basically populated by golden guys and gals who've had lots of opportunities and never stumbled. Now, clearly, you've had some very fine opportunities, but you've also been pretty open, even, you know, a minute ago, but also on your podcast, that you did stumble professionally. And I think, by the way, that the key to admitting that you failed is also showing that you picked yourself up and moved on and probably are a stronger person as a result of having stumbled. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened? I mean, we're kind of dancing around the topic.
Sure. So after I finished working on Wall Street, it was right during the Great Recession.
Right.
And at that time, a lot of stuff was going on in New York around that time, as far as not only just in Wall Street, but the economy. Like,
yeah.
It was like September, like 2008, when a lot of stuff was hitting the fan.
Right.
And I think at that point, a lot of what I was thinking about or going through was trying to decide if this was what I really wanted to do with my life as far as finance. A lot of people, I mean, I think your listeners can appreciate this, because I think a lot of them see business school as an opportunity for 2 years to take a deeper dive and to really consider what is it you really want to do, or if you want to switch careers, or you want to dig deeper in what you're doing. So I was kind of having that moment before business school, and I was just asking myself, given what was going on in the Great Recession in the news each day, was this what I really wanted to do? And my answer was not really. Like, I've learned quite a bit during my time on Wall Street. I'm absolutely grateful for the experience I've had, and definitely draw on a lot of those experiences in the classroom now and definitely will for the rest of my career. I just felt like I wanted to take things in a different direction, and I was really interested in real estate and entrepreneurship at the time. And I just felt like, wouldn't this be a better time to take a risk? Even despite, like, I guess, you know, in some sense, I didn't completely consider all the risks that came about with this whole economy downturn, but there's a part of me that said, you know what, you're young, you've done well thus far, you know, if this doesn't go well, hopefully we can pick ourselves back up, and if not, and if it does go well, then even great, and then you feel even better about taking the risk. So, you know, I started a real estate investment firm in North New Jersey, and right out of my place of residence, and I ran into some challenges early on that I didn't see beforehand, and ultimately, a few things as far as what came out of that were, and these are part of the reasons why I applied to HBS, as far as what things I learned from that experience that I wanted to get better at. One was, it was just a one-man shop for me. Right. It was just me. And oftentimes with startups, that's usually how I get started before you build a team. But at that point, what I was learning during my experience, that it was a lot tougher to get things done when you were dependent on yourself to talk to clients, to get contracts done, to, you know, do marketing, to make sure your entity set up. Like, it's just like everything. Like, I truly did value the importance of having a team and people that are, you know, specializing in certain functions, certain abilities, that when you're all added together, you're much, much more able to get a lot of more done than you can by yourself. So that was one where I was like, that was a key lesson number one, as far as I wanted to be in a better situations of learning what it means to operate in a team, because I knew that the next time I start up the startup, I wanted to be able to delegate and also work with team members that work in different areas. The second one was I wanted to have a better, more solid foundation in business and general management, for that matter. I think that from what I learned from books and from talking to people and just straight trial and error and hard knocks, as people want to call it, you learn a lot from that experience, and I take nothing from that. However, at the same time, I do feel like there is a value to having at least some sort of foundation in business, whether it's finance, marketing, or even operations, as we talked about before,
right?
And how it can apply to what you're doing. And I feel like there's a couple of hurdles I could have passed more easily having that sort of foundation like I would have with an MBA than I could otherwise. Now, is that to say that an MBA is absolutely prerequisite to starting your own business? Absolutely not. You can look anywhere on the internet, Wikipedia or Google, to find plenty of examples of people or founders that have started businesses without going to business school. I just felt like for me, at that particular time, this would be a great way to learn that in the concentrated 2 years, as opposed to trying to pick pieces for a lot longer than that. And then the last thing I would say, Linda, is wanted to become a better leader. And that was another thing that drew me to HBS as well. HBS is known for its reputation of building and grooming leaders who will make a difference in the world. And that's seen in the curriculum, the scene in how people carry themselves, it's seen in the type of people they admit.
Absolutely.
And what they look for. So for me, I felt like even if I have a team, I would see myself as leading that team. And what type of leader am I currently, and what leader can I potentially become? And that was something where I feel like the next startup I started, I wanted to be an even better leader to go through both the good and the bad times to help, you know, with the team through whatever difficulties or successes we go through along the way. And I felt like business school would help me out with that. So, you know, long story short, we had about a 2-year run on that before I moved back home to Memphis to work at FedEx for the next 3 years in different functions before ultimately coming to HBS.
Okay. But just from my perspective, just to add my 2 cents to your story, I think that you're 100% right that revealing your failure, being a little bit vulnerable, maybe even showing a little humility through that experience, it certainly was the right approach to take. But what really would have nailed it would have been your showing how you bounce back from it. And here I'm not so much talking to you specifically, but to anybody listening. In other words, I don't think that Harvard is specifically looking for people who have failed, though they're not opposed to it. But what they really want to see is the resilience that allows you to bounce back. To just say, okay, I'm going to pick myself up. I'm going to go on next challenge.
Absolutely. And what I probably would add, you might not know this about me, Linda, is I'm actually a reapplicant.
I didn't know that. Yeah, I didn't know that.
So I'm actually a reapplicant. So I actually applied 2 years ago to be a member of the class of 2014 that just graduated.
Got it.
And at that time, I just was getting my feet wet at FedEx, working in their global citizenship team. And I applied. It was the only school I applied because I sort of chose to apply on a whim to some degree. I think it was second round I applied. And I was like, well, I don't have much time to get the application together, but, you know, this is my top choice, and let's just apply to HBS. And so essentially I was waitlisted, and later I guess they call it relieved or taken off of it later on.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of those things that when you talk about resilience and bouncing back, that was another one too. Like I remember that day when I found out I got taken off, and that was a long nap I took at that point because I couldn't do anything else. I was like, Mom, I'll just see you like tomorrow. I'm just going to take a nap. And what was supposed to be at 1 hour later became like 10 hours because I couldn't do anything else. But when you talk about resilience, I think what I did from there was focus on a couple of things. One, I wanted to improve my GMAT score. Two, I wanted to continue my work experience as far as finding other areas of responsibility to rise up and where I was to take on projects of, you know, either higher visibility or to gain certain skills to be helpful, including like working on social media right before I left for HBS.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the last thing was doing a deeper dive as far as what I really wanted to do post-MBA. I think at the time I was sort of going with the flow of kind of like in groupthink as far as if people thought consulting was the way to go, then you think consulting, or if it was finance, you think something similar, as opposed to, let's go back to the vulnerable piece, really digging deep down and saying, what do I truly want to do with, as HBS likes to call it, my one wild and precious life. So from there, I had a much more self-awareness than I did the first time around when I applied. And hopefully, I like to believe that had a factor as far as things becoming better this time around than before. I won't know that for sure, but at least I can sleep easy at night believing that may have some sort of factor to do
with
it.
Absolutely. Okay. Now, can you tell us a little bit, is HBS as good as it seems from the outside looking in? And what do you like best about your life as an HBS MBA?
You know, the thing is that I am absolutely an advocate for Harvard Business School. Like, I'm excited for the people that recently got, you know, great news about round one invitations as far as acceptances,
yeah.
I think that yesterday. It's one of those things that's like, I don't necessarily work firsthand with admissions, but I'm definitely that person that will love to tell the world about how great HBS is. I think for me, one of the things I love most about HBS is the type of people you come across every day. I like how it's broken up into sections. You have 900-plus people, and they're broken up into 10 sections, 90-plus people in each section. And they do a great job of really making that each section a microcosm of the entire student body, meaning that you definitely have your fair share of international students from a wide variety of countries. Like, it's almost like when you look at each class card, it's like every third class card has some name that is definitely not American, that's foreign, or might have an accent.
It's hard to pronounce.
Hard to pronounce, all the above. You have people from different backgrounds, different nationalities, different races, different genders, socioeconomic statuses, different backgrounds, different companies, like, you know, manufacturing or finance or Silicon Valley or private equity. I love the aspect of being around really smart people that are down to earth at the same time, are willing to learn from each other, and really want to grow as a section each semester. So it's one of those things that, for me, means a lot to me as far as that, as far as the people. And not to say that I don't go out through my section to learn and to hang out and be with other people, either in my first year group or the second year. I just think section experience is a big, 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 big thing. And if it's something where maybe some of your listeners are a little bit intimidated by the size of it, maybe they think HBS is too big as far as 900 people, I think the section experience makes things a lot more digestible, I would say, more bite-sized. That's one that I like. The other one I like is that there always seems to be, I almost would want to equate HBS as the New York City of business schools. And what I mean by that is with New York City, even when I was there working on Wall Street, it always seemed like there was something to do each day.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the acronym FOMO or fear of missing out definitely is a part of HBS life here, because it almost seems like every single day, even on Saturdays and Sundays, there's always something you can do. There's a section event, there's a party, there's a get-together, there's a speaking engagement, there's a conference, there's a cultural show, there's something happening at the graduate school education or at the college, there's something happening within Cambridge or in Boston. And I think one of the things I've learned so far early on in my first semester is the importance of not only time management, but more importantly, priority management.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that, Linda, is you can't do everything each day.
Right.
And you have to make choices. And sometimes you have to make tough choices as far as what things you're going to do and what things you're not going to do. What classes will you be a part of? What classes you won't be a part of? I know I definitely will experience that when it comes to choosing classes for second year, but also what events you're going to do each night and which ones you're not. And I think for anybody that's looking at life after business school, as adults, that's a great reflection of how life will be like.
Absolutely.
I'm
well after business school. I'm still making those tough choices and having those challenges. So.
Absolutely. Where it's like you have to make certain trade-offs. And I think business school is a great way to help you practice that in somewhat of a safe environment. And for that matter, you become more accustomed to it. So when you exit business school, you have your career and your family and your social activities and your charity or whatever you have on your schedule, you understand that every day there's always something coming on. You have to better manage your schedule because not everyone can have personal assistants. Not everyone can have automatic ads on Outlook, you know, as far as your calendar items or whatnot. And you have to be able to manage your time. You have to manage your priorities, and you have to also manage your energy as well, because there's so many things that go on, it can be tiring. So figuring out when you have time to rest, when you have time for yourself, when you have time to do things that help you de-stress. It's one of the things that I think business school and HBS, they don't say this a lot. They don't in their booklets or websites or whatnot. But it's definitely one that you'll definitely experience while at business school.
Right. And I do think it's a lifelong challenge.
Absolutely.
And it's not a bad challenge. I have an elderly mother who's basically a very upbeat person. And one day, very suddenly there had to be work done in her house. My father had passed away shortly before then. And she came over and she was staying with us for a few days. And she came in and she looked absolutely miserable. And she just said to me, Linda, I have nothing to do. And she'd been, you know, taking care of my father devotedly. She was managing the house. She didn't have to manage the house. She couldn't be in the house. She didn't have my father. He just passed away. I don't need care at the moment. And she was, so I just gave her something to do. It didn't matter what. She just, she felt utterly useless, and she just was miserable. I'd never seen her, I've never since seen her looking so down.
Okay.
And I think, she recently moved into a retirement community, and there's lots of activities for her, you know, lots of things to do, and she is always so busy. And she'll half complaining, say, oh, I'm so busy. I'm like, you know, just stay busy, Mom. It's okay. It's fine. It's good.
Right.
It's fine. And this, you know, we complain sometimes about, you know, fear of missing out and the challenge of prioritizing and time management and all that. Yes, it is a challenge, but it's also a wonderful challenge because it means there are lots and lots of opportunities and things to do. And obviously,
absolutely,
HBS offers a wealth of those kinds of things. What would you like to see changed or improved at Harvard?
You know, it's an interesting question. And part of that is when I look at my first semester, what do I feel like would make things easier or better? And it's kind of a first world problem, I would say, too, like just to kind of give a disclaimer. Part of what I would say is I wish there wasn't as much work to do after class. And the reason why I say that is because, and there's also kind of a corollary to this as well. The reason why I say it, first of all, is because there's so many things outside of school to do, whether it's clubs and organizations or social events or what have you, it does make it very challenging to figure out what things you're going to do and what things you don't. at the same time, you have to also understand Harvard, when it comes to like grading and that sort of thing, is different from other schools. And how they teach is different from other schools. I mean, the case method, I would say, brings a certain sense of leniency when it comes to academic experience compared to other schools. And what I mean by that is, when you're discussing cases, you have 90-plus people in your class that are going to have this sort of class discussion. It's absolutely expected for you to be prepared to be able to contribute, you know, when called upon. But there's also times and classes I've realized where, you know, today may not be the day you get called on in class to give your comment. And the thing that comes out of that, I learned that really quickly in the first couple of weeks, is you could prepare for a case 4 or 5 hours, done the exhibits, done the spreadsheets, been completely ready, had all your answers to the questions ready to go. And the next day might not be your day to get called on. So
yeah.
Now what I like about business school brings up another benefit or another thing to learn, because that goes with how you allocate your time. And it's almost like, I don't want to call it gambling, but it's almost like some sort of risk-reward you're playing, because you may allocate time to do some things outside of class and feel like, okay, you know, I'll study the case, you know, I'll wake up a little bit earlier and make sure I'm prepared, or go to my learning group, and they may help me as well with a couple of things I have some trouble with, just in case I get cold called in the class. And there may be some times where you might say, you know what, I had a great time last night at this event. I'm just going to take a chance. I might not get called on.
Right, right.
Now, the corollary is, when I applied to 3 business schools. I applied to Harvard Business School. This is the second time around, right?
Right.
I applied to Harvard Business School, Stanford, and Wharton.
Okay.
And
HSW.
I got into the what?
I say HSW.
Oh, yeah, HSW, absolutely. So I got accepted into Wharton, and I did not get an interview at Stanford. No regrets whatsoever. That's just part of the process. But one of the things I did reflect on early in my time at HBS was, I thought about it, and I was like, well, you know, I'm the type of person that gets involved with a lot of activities. And I do it to test some, like, my time and energy and how much I can take on. Like, involved in a number of different organizations. You know, I recently just got cast in the HBS show, which will be out in April. Just, like, my schedule is very, very busy, along with doing a startup as well. And I asked myself the question, Linda, I said, could this fly at somewhere like Wharton? And that's where I got really grateful. I got really grateful because, for example, Wharton, for some of its classes, require problem sets to turn it for class. That's something, like, that's homework you have to turn in on your own. You're not dependent on anybody to help you. That's all on you. There's no learning group. There's no class discussion on it. That's all on you. And I said to myself, I probably would either have to significantly cut down on the stuff I do outside of class, or I would academically get burned out trying to keep everything intact. And so, as much as I would say, like, the change is, like, you know, less work for us to do so we can take advantage of more stuff outside of class and the whole student life experience, I'm also grateful because, you know, it gets back to time and priority management, and that's just a challenge and a struggle I'm going through and I'm growing through as well. But I also know that it could be a lot more challenging if you have, instead of the case study method, if you have problems that you have to individually do and you have to turn in for a grade, not like, you know, the ranking they do at HBS as far as the 1, 2, or 3, but this is like 85, 90, 70, 65.
Yeah, sure.
And some people in some schools don't have, like, non-grade disclosure as well. And so I think part of it to me is when you include all that together, that does have a factor. And one, acknowledging how things could be better for you personally, but then also being thankful that it actually could be more challenging on your end, personally taxing and challenging, if you were at another school as well.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, these are not supposed to be easy. So
yeah, absolutely.
So if you were to summarize your response, would you say you wish there was less outside of class work? Or do you just kind of think that's necessary?
I know it's a necessary evil, so to speak. It's one of those things that, you know, it causes me to make time and priority decisions. But that's probably the best I could say as far as what I like to see change, if I could just a little less outside of classwork, that's all, just a little less.
All right. Did anything really surprise you about Harvard?
What really surprised me, I would say, is the extent of not only collaboration, but just attachedness and caring within the student body. Harvard Business School, I think the reputation is a lot better than it has been before, but it used to have a reputation of being really cutthroat competitive.
Right, absolutely.
Where it's just like, you're on your own, like, don't share your notes with this person because they'll copy what you have to write, like, what you have to share, and then they'll put your notes in the shredder and say, I have nothing, I don't know where it went, I don't know. And then you have to figure out what to do about your notes before class. And what I feel like has been surprising for me is that, you know, of course, you know, you'll have people who have their own perceptions or opinions about what HBS is about, what they perceive it to be. You know, cutthroat competitiveness, it comes up the majority of time. But what I've seen, especially within my section, is we're all really out to help each other. And it's shown a number of different ways, whether it's through the learning group that happens in the morning where you have people sharing their financial models with you or helping explain a certain concept or help you answer certain questions just in case you might get cold called. Or it might be in a sense like, you know, recently this semester we've had a couple of our section mates have to leave for personal reasons. Mm-hmm. And it honestly was heartbreaking for us to lose these people where – whereas for somebody thinking like a cutthroat competitive setting, you might be like, all right, good. You know, he's gone. You know, that means I'll have a better chance of getting a certain grade. Or I'll be, you know, this, you know, get, you know, I'll be a Baker scholar for sure now. Instead, it's like that didn't even factor into the equation. It was more of this person is gone. We're going to miss them. We want to stay in touch. Like even to the point of like tears being shed in the last class today, when we realized it's going to be the last class we were going to have with this person altogether because he was going to be gone for 2 years. So by the time he gets back, we'll already have graduated.
Yeah.
So I feel that's a great example. Another great example is, mm-hmm. you know, last night we had a candlelight vigil for the Mike Brown and Eric Garner incidents that have been in the news lately.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that goes back to the collaboration, the sharing, the community that's not cutthroat about HBS is over 500 people came to this vigil last night, a vigil that we heard from a professor last night. There's never been a vigil done at Harvard Business School like this before.
Really?
And over 500 people came by, both first years and second years, and people from outside of Harvard Business School as well coming in. And just the number of faces where initially this might be seen as just an African-American issue or minority issue, you saw people from all across the board, including international students as well. And the reason why they came was because they felt attached because that's their section mate that's talking. That's mm-hmm. their friend that's sharing their story about how they might have been affected by this incident. And that they were willing to take part of their night to be able to be supportive and to be at a vigil like that. And that, to me, so quickly, it's only been a semester. I might think about this towards the end of the year, but already in just a semester, literally about 3 or 4 months, that sort of feeling, I think, to me, has been the most surprising and also the most encouraging out of my time here at HBS so far.
Great. I also, what's coming to mind is I interviewed Casey Gerald of MBAs Across America.
And, I love Casey.
Yeah,
he's definitely been a great help to me as well.
Right. I interviewed him and his and the other people who did the first MBA Across America internship. That was episode 18, info.accepted.com/18, if anybody wants to go and check it out. And in it, he talked about apparently when they first tried MBAs Across America, they didn't get the funding, or they didn't get the approval they were supposed to get. They were missing something they needed to really get this going. And they went to their advisor and they said, you know, we really don't think we're going to be able to do this. And the advisor was an HBS professor, and the professor said, no, you have to do this. This is a great idea. Let me get on the phone and see what I can do for you. And, of course, he got on the phone. He did whatever he could do. It worked. And, you know, the rest is history. They did their summer internship with MBA Across America. We had another interview with Casey and Mike Baker after that, and when they were already launching MBA Across America as a movement. Let me see if I can find that. I'll share that number also. Yeah, it was that was number 51, info.accept.com/51. And I'm going to have them back because it's a great story, and it's they're wonderful to interview also. But the fact that the professor was like, no, you got to do this. I'm going to help you. So it's obviously that feeling is among the students, but it's also among the staff at HBS. And I think there has been a change in the culture at HBS. It certainly had a very different reputation. And what I'm hearing now, and also from the administration to the students, it was definitely a different attitude years ago. So it's nice to see it different. Now, you mentioned the case method a minute ago. Now that you're in it, how do you like it? Have you been cold called? How do you prepare for a case?
Well, I'm hoping, Linda, that none of my professors for my next semester are listening to this right now, so they take note. But I have not been cold called, thankfully, and I think a lot of that has to do with I'm very, if you can't tell by now, I'm a very opinionated, very talkative-like person. I don't mind sharing my viewpoints on things.
Okay.
And so that definitely helps when it comes to being cold called or not being cold called. So hopefully I can keep that up for next semester as well. do I find the case method difficult? I think I don't see it difficult when it comes to reading the case, answering some questions, and being able to share your viewpoints. I think what makes it challenging, though, is when you get beyond just yourself doing the case method. When you look at it from the standpoint, like HBS has a certain way as far as you individually prepare for it, then you bounce off ideas and you share with a small discussion group in the morning, usually about 6 people, and then you go into class and you share amongst 90-plus people. And I think the progression of that is the whole sense of you come up with your own perspective and your own viewpoints, and as you start to open yourself up to other people's opinions and perspectives, and you start to consider those, you debate them, you argue against them, you try to find support either way, and your opinions and perspectives may be different from what they were the night before now. And now it goes from 6 people you talk about this case to now 90-plus people. And maybe you have somebody in the classroom who has resident experience in this particular matter. Maybe they worked at the same company that the protagonist was working at. Maybe you have an international student that brings in a certain perspective that makes you open your eyes a little bit more. And so it's almost in a sense that there's a sense of unpredictability once you get into the classroom setting of where things are, because even when the class is over, I think your opinion and perspective after class may be completely different from your opinion or perspective before you went into learning group. And I think that's probably the biggest challenge from the case method, because I think oftentimes in education, you're supposed to come up with the answer for yourself, and you just share your answer, and that's it. You're pretty much done, good job, and you move on. It's the whole sense of being able to open yourself up to other people's perspectives and to consider them, not just dismiss them, but consider them. And those perspectives may be persuasive. They may persuade you in a way where it's like, I see that person's rationale behind it, or I understand their reasoning, or this actually really gets me emotionally where I feel really drawn to this. And I think that's the challenging part, where can people open themselves up to other people's perspectives?
Right.
Or are you the person that is so caught up in your own idea that your idea is the only idea, the only way out, it's always right, and there can't be any question to that? I think that's the type of person that if you're an applicant going to HBS, that's something you have to at least be really quick to address upon if you're able to come here, because I think that's the expectation when you come here, that you are going to be more open. You are going to be able to share your experiences. You are going to be vulnerable in front of these 90 people. You can't be scared. You can't be closed-minded. You have to be willing to participate both in a give-and-take type of relationship with the rest of your classmates.
Right. A friend of mine years ago described the case method as a way of forcing you to examine a situation or problem from multiple perspectives. And, mm-hmm. and if you're really going to do that, well, first of all, I think if you're going to be an effective leader, you have to be willing to listen and consider different perspectives. So I think it goes back to your earlier point about Harvard being this incubator of leaders.
Absolutely.
I'm sure I had cases when I was in business school, but it certainly wasn't a case method approach. But that insight from that friend of mine, I think very much summarizes what you're saying, that this mm-hmm. ability to look at things from multiple perspectives and consider the opinions of different people, the experiences of different people, is what the case method is about. It's also it is a hallmark of leadership.
Absolutely.
Now, there are rumors, I've heard rumors, that you need a lot of money for social activities and extracurricular activities if you're going to go to Harvard Business School, but it can be rather elitist in that regard, almost snobby. Have you found that, or do you disagree with that?
We actually did a case that highlighted this aspect of HBS life, and it was actually interesting to go through. And I think the big thing is not only going through that case, but also going through this first semester at HBS, I honestly would agree and disagree.
Okay.
And why I agree and disagree with this is because it really depends on what you want to engage in while here.
Yeah.
You're going to have activities on campus or off campus with HBS students that simply, hey, let's just go to the grill or the cafeteria and let's just have a good meal while watching Monday Night Football on the big screen TV.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's basically cost of dinner where you would buy food from anywhere else. And just enjoying that with your friends while watching football.
Right.
That can be one end of the spectrum, or even I'll go even past that. It might be in the sense of, hey, we're going to have a little get-together, kind of a think and drink, and where we're going to talk about the book Lean In by Sheryl Sandberg. And mm-hmm. basically the cost out of that might be maybe a taxi ride to go to a person's apartment, or maybe you bring in a bottle of wine to, help, with the whole logistics of the event. You can figure out that maybe it's about 10 to 20 bucks or something like that, maybe at most, if, depending on what you want to spend. Now, that's kind of on the low end, or you can even do things for free. And there's a high end as well where I've seen, students go on trips to Vegas or Miami over Halloween.
Right.
Just to be part of the party over there. It's like there wasn't a particular event. It was just like, hey, instead of being out in the cold weather of Boston, let's enjoy Halloween being outside, like somewhere in like Miami or Vegas for that matter. Or instead of spending Thanksgiving back at home as we've done every year, I want to do something different, go to Thanksgiving in Dominican Republic with some mm-hmm. students of mine. These probably will cost a little more than 15, 20 bucks, I would imagine.
Right. And
I think the big thing is that it really does depend on your budget. It really depends on how important it is to you. Neither of those two scenarios are required to have a social life here. It does get back to the FOMO because when you look on Facebook, honestly, and you see pictures of people from different locations or at different events or different formals, and you might be like, man, I missed out. I wish I would have done this, or I couldn't do that because I didn't have enough money to do this. Or you may feel the same way for events that, were free and you just couldn't go because your time didn't allow you to do so as far as your schedule is concerned. I honestly would say, Linda, it really does depend. I don't agree with the stereotype that you have to have a lot of money to have a social life, But I will say at the same time, it's on a spectrum.
Right.
You can enjoy.
Isn't that life, though?
It is. It honestly is, Linda. It's just like, you know, I may spend Christmas, you know, with my family back at home, or I might spend Christmas in, like, I don't know, like Shenzhen, China, or the Bahamas, or China,
right.
Or, you know, I might go, you know, to Goa, India for New Year's, as opposed to just staying at home. It all comes by choice. It's you know, I think you hit it in the mark right there. It really is a sense of life in general.
Right.
You know, just like we talked about time and priority management, it's mm-hmm. also about financial management as well. What do you want to do with the money that you have? You know, do you want to go all out for this event, or go across the country to the party, or go to this wine festival, or do you want to keep things a little more economical? These are all things you'll face outside of HBS as well. So it's another example of HBS in its own way sharing with you what life will be like afterwards and the type of decisions you will have to make as an adult, which mirror what regular people make as far as trade-offs every day as well.
Absolutely. No, I agree with you. Also, HBS, as you mentioned, has over 900 people in it, and you can expect that some of them are going to be wealthier. Hello.
Absolutely.
That's life.
It is. When you work wherever you work after school, it's just like you're going to come across people that drive, you know, Honda Civics, and you may come across people that drive BMWs, or
right. Even
more, like, you know, Lamborghinis. You might have the off chance of seeing someone in a Bentley, or
that's right.
And it's kind of how life is. And I think what I like about HBS is that it doesn't try to hide that. It doesn't try to actively try to, quote unquote, normalize things where everyone seems to be on the same playing field. And the real issue is, I mean, that's not. You're going to have students that, you know, are from one socioeconomic status that may be more lower class as far as, like, mm-hmm. you know, finances are concerned, or middle class. And you may have people that are, like, the sons and daughters of, like, CEOs or heads
right.
of state.
I think
that, absolutely, like, you know, that they don't have to worry about much financially. But I think, you know, you hit the nail on the mark, Linda, as well. It's just like that's a part of life. But it's also another part about HBS that you can appreciate as well as a student, because being able to mix people of different socioeconomic statuses and backgrounds in a shared environment, as far as we go to class together, we argue cases together, we go to events together. We now, when we leave HBS, will be calling each other, staying in touch by LinkedIn or Facebook or what have you, going to each other's weddings, being invited to certain baby showers and what have you. And it's regardless of the fact as far as what income is, where some people would say, well, only the rich party with the rich and the not-so-rich party with the not-so-rich. And this is kind of a more of a mixing ground where it's not so much based on income, but more so just about people, just getting people together. And if you happen to get along with certain people and they happen to be of a certain socioeconomic status, it's not really entering the equation, because it's more based on what it should matter on, and it's more so on, do me and this person get along well? Are
right.
we the type of people that we can be friends regardless, like seeing past that? And that's where I see a lot of good in what's happening at HBS, and it probably is being echoed as well in other business schools as well. But I can only speak about HBS in this instance.
Right. Now, this, I assume in a few weeks you're going to be going on your field immersion experience for leadership development, or field project.
Yeah.
Where will you be doing
yeah.
that? And can you tell us a little bit about it?
So it'll be the week of, I believe, January 4th to 13th. I'll be traveling with my team of six on a field project to Mumbai, India.
Wow.
And, never been to India before, so definitely looking forward to that. So we'll be there for about a week, and basically with Field 2, as they call it, you're working on a certain project with a certain company. Sometimes the company may have somebody that's an alum of HBS, maybe sometimes the partner company is not. But essentially, you work on a project to help that company with a certain product they're trying to launch or to modify, and it's basically you do a lot of preparation before you leave to go on your immersion project field trip. To prepare yourself, and then the whole aspect of you coming there for that week is basically to enact on what you've been preparing on before. And then on top of that, you've done so much work while in the United States, and now it's good to test how you are in a different country, in a different culture, oftentimes a different language, to see if what you came out in theory or on a whiteboard, does that really translate in a practical sense, real time. I mean, honestly, field was another reason why I like HBS, because I didn't want to get caught up just on theory and frameworks, but I want a nice balance between what is said to be the right way to go about it and also being able to test that in real time and to see if there's opportunities where you have to pivot from there, or you might have to adapt certain things and make certain tweaks. So theory and practice was definitely important to me when it came to looking for schools, and the case method and the field method definitely provides that. And that's one of the things that, you know, like I said before, we'll definitely get a sense of once we actually touch down in Mumbai and we test these presentations and concepts and ideas in real time in actual Mumbai to see if they work and see what comes out that can help out the partner company by the end of that week.
Sounds good. It should be very interesting. I spent a few days in India for an ISB conference. It was fascinating. I didn't have time to tour, but it was fascinating.
Absolutely.
So, okay, let's change topics a little bit here. Now, you have a weekly podcast about your life at HBS. Why did you decide to start the podcast?
You know, I started it for two reasons. Actually three. The first one is I love podcasts. I used to do podcasts before coming to HBS. They're, like, I'm sitting here at my desk right now looking right at my mic on my desk that I talk to each week. Uh-huh. I don't know. There's a part of me that likes being able to speak, whether, you know, public speaking or tape speaking as far as, behind a video, in front of a video camera or behind a mic as far as, like, radio or podcast. I don't know. Maybe that might be part of my career post-HBS. We'll have to see. Right. But I think that was one where I wanted to continue to develop that and develop that skill, I would like to say, as far as speaking goes. Uh-huh. The second one was, you know, before coming to HBS, a lot of people, you know, once they know you're going to HBS, are like, hey, you know, make sure you do this, make sure you do that, make sure you stay in touch. I want to know all about it. You know, can you tell me how this class went? Can you tell me how this week went? And the number of people that ask you that honestly can add up, where you now have like 20, 30 people to keep tabs on a monthly basis, or friends and family saying, you know, calling you each Sunday and saying, hey, can you give me the rundown of what happened this past week? And so what you're doing is now you're repeating the same thing you're saying over and over and over again, hours on end, where you're basically spending hours of your Sunday pretty much regurgitating to different people what happened the previous week. And so I said to myself, you know, how can I don't know, maybe that's a part of the operations that I've learned, or maybe something I learned in class actually that I actually retain, but how can I make this more effective or more efficient? And part of it was, maybe I should start a podcast show where each week I'll time it, and it's like 20 minutes or less. I'll try to keep that 20 minutes.
Through our time limit here, but you're being very generous. You're being very generous with your time.
Absolutely, no problem. So, you know, just 20 minutes or less, be able to share what happened the previous week, whether good, bad, or what have you, and not so much just class, but also the whole HBS experience. I think it's helpful not only for friends and family to stay in touch so they know what's going on, so I don't have to worry about 10, 12 phone calls to make on a Sunday. To keep people updated. But I think it's also helpful for prospective applicants where if they're looking at HBS or business school in general, you know, the third reason why I started the show was because I honestly didn't see anybody doing this from a student's perspective. I saw a need where a hole in the ground where basically, you know, you have people talk about business schools but from different lenses, which they're all important. But I think a missing lens to add in there to supplement everyone else is, what about the student that's actually there? Like, what is it, once you've gotten accepted, once you are in class and you're taking part in these activities, what is it like for you? And so my hope is, like, while I'm doing this at Harvard Business School and trying to apply to business school in general, my hope is over the years, we'll have other people being able to do podcasts, whether at Kellogg or at Duke or at Stanford or numerous business schools across the country and around the world, even to some of the international business schools, where people can be able to access like current or recently graduated students' insights on how their experience was, to be able to provide that so people have a sense of context of what is it like to be a student at this particular business school.
Maybe you'll start a MBA network for applicants, students, grads, schools. How do you like that?
I wouldn't be opposed to that at all.